This is the Automotive Repair Podcast Network.
Welcome, everyone, to yet another episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z. I'm Matt Fonzel, and see, if you'd stick to your 12-point maintenance program, we won't have to jumpstart you like this. That and more after a word from our sponsors, Pico Technology, Autel, and Independent Wrench Jobs. Are you chasing elusive automotive problems? Pico Technology empowers you to see what's really happening. Pinpoint faults in sensors, wiring, and components with unmatched accuracy. Picoscope oscilloscopes transform your diagnostic capabilities. Visit PicoAuto.com, that's PicoAuto.com, and revolutionize your diagnostics today. Autel delivers award-winning automotive diagnostic tools trusted by technicians across North America. Backed by Autel North America experts in sales, training, and technical support. From drivability diagnostics and TPMS service to ADAS and advanced safety systems, Autel helps technicians follow OEM procedures and repair with confidence. Learn more at autel.com. Sponsored by Independent Wrench Jobs, tech-only jobs, no runaround. Built by Technician Find, helping tech since 2017. Join free at independentwrenchjobs.com. All right, I thought I'd kind of go through some question answering with messages coming in that, I don't know, I guess we could call it a mailbag type of an episode, but I don't know. I guess I just thought some of the questions are pretty good and they're worthy of discussion, and many are kind of in the auto repair realm and others not so much. And it seems, I don't get messages and notes and comments and just in conversation when I run into people that some people really, really like that. And some would like to stick to the automotive stuff. So I guess I'll just kind of bounce back and forth and do a little bit of both, right? The first question is, it's kind of rough. It's asking why I, Matt, struggle when kind of like discussing electricity in the context. And, you know, there's a few of these messages like that where I kind of avoid the subject. And I think it's because many classes get into like, try to get into the fundamentals of electricity, and it gets very, very messy really, really fast. And I don't know how it helps any of us. And I don't even really want to communicate or mislead anyone into thinking I really know what's going on either. I think on a conceptual basis, yes, but it really, really comes down to it. And by that, I mean, when it really comes down to it, it's math. That's what it is, because the reality is there's no way to visualize an accurate representation of particles. It's really what it comes down to, particles. And by particles, it's really quantum fields. And that's the reality. That is what makes up particles, is excitations, if you will, or if you want to sound like we're really, really, I guess, physicists or know what we're talking about, we would say perturbations of a quantum field. That's what particles are. And sometimes they behave like the little spheres or ping pong balls or whatever you want to call them, orbs, that spheres that race across something. And then sometimes they act like waves. Really, the best representation of that, or the best example of that, is something called Young's experiment, or I think it's really most often referred to as the double slit experiment. You could actually reproduce this if you wanted. I'm not saying it would be easy, but you can do it with a decent laser pointer and either some string, or if you're really, really, really good with tape, depending on the laser pointer itself. What happens is, yeah, I guess we'll come up with a, basically try to reconstruct a thought experiment, if you will. You're standing in front of a wall, and the wall is, we'll just say, what, 20 feet away. And in that wall, there are two missing columns, if you will, the width of a basketball or a soccer ball or a kickball. And then you have a whole bunch of, like a row of soccer balls to just, you know, that'll kind of almost like a pinball machine or whatever will set down in front of you. You kick it, set it down in front of you and you kick it. If you do that long enough, you're going to kick some through those slits. Right? Those columns, the missing columns. Let's just say these soccer balls, or we'll just say there's a wall behind this wall with the slits. that, you know, will leave a mark wherever these soccer balls hit, you would expect to see two columns behind it where those soccer balls hit. They go through the slit and they hit that wall behind their canvas or net or whatever. And you would see evidence of them hitting kind of the same area over and over and over directly behind those slits. That makes perfect sense, right? And that is on the macro scale. Things go differently when we start winding down to the micro scale or the particle sizes. And it can go a little bit larger than particles themselves. But what happens is that at that small size, and now instead of using soccer balls, let's figure out how we can do this where you are kicking electrons or your idea of an electron, which it's not a sphere, but at least for the sake of this discussion, that's what we're going to say. And now you start kicking the electrons. The results aren't the same. You're not going to get two columns behind those slits. You're going to get what's called an interference pattern, where the intensity of maybe those two columns right behind where the slits are will be the brightest. But then there'll be a gap to the left or right of that, and there'll be another column. It's a little bit fainter. And then there'll be a space of nothing, you know, where it's clean. And then there'll be another column. So this is called an interference pattern. And if we just had, you know, waves of water crashing up against this wall with these two slits, you would get the same pattern. And that's why we have what's called particle wave duality. And that's just a hint of how messed up things are, right? Like, to me, it's amazing. It's an amazing thing. Our universe is just full of wonder. Reality is, in some cases, stranger than anything we could come up with. Stranger than fiction. I wrestle with that. How can I take that and roll that into something that's usable for us to fix taillights or headlights or CAN communications? And I don't think I can. I don't think we should. But then we need to kind of avoid the whole theory thing. Or if we talk about theory, let's just say call it what it is. This is like the applicability theory. We're just going to keep this to where it's applicable to help you imagine something that's useful enough to do what you need to do 99.9% of the time. And it will fall apart on certain things, explaining certain phenomena like crossfire with plug wires, the capacitive discharge or inductive misfire, like two wires running too close together and there's enough of a electromagnetic wave on the one to induce a voltage in the other, or at least significant enough, right? The water theories and all that don't explain that at all. And it's fine. It's usually not that big of a deal. Same with noise when scoping high speed signals with certain types of test leads, that we get noise or ringing. The ringing isn't from the circuit itself, it's from our test leads. That's where some of this stuff could help explain that, but does it matter? And I don't know that it does. And that's why I hate talking about it, because one, I think it misrepresents my intent, which is honestly, how can it be as accurate as possible? How can we really be accurate and applicable? And I think when it gets down to it, sometimes we just can't. As the truth is really, really complex. The reality is picturing things at quantum levels, if you will, which is where electricity lives, cannot be done. The human brain cannot visualize such things. We try to, we come up with gimmicks, and honestly, a lot of them are really good and they're good enough for the vast, vast majority of what we do. But that's why I struggle with it. That's why I just sit there wrestling with it and I don't know what to do with it. And, you know, why is it important to even bring up the truth if the truth is so complex? And it's like, well, because I think we all want to know the truth. At least I do. I want to know what's really happening, what's really going on. At some point you hit where you're down the rabbit hole far enough that find yourself climbing back out, dusting yourself off and sticking with some applicability for a while. But you know, once you know what's down that rabbit hole, it's really hard to forget about it. And really just wanting to be able to be on the level and have it useful. And Sometimes it really is. Sometimes you can do it. There's subjects where you can really do that. And then there's some where it's, I haven't figured it out. I don't know. And maybe it's me. That's really why I struggle with the discussion. And what do you do with that? Next question, a little less automotive related. And what's kind of cool is multiple of these. What lawnmower should I buy? They must have heard like Pollock and I talking about this once, or I don't know, overheard us somewhere, or I'm sure we've talked about it on a podcast somewhere at one time. I need to know more. I need more data. And it doesn't make sense, really. One could make an argument that it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend commercial dollars, commercial or professional dollars on a mower if you have, you know, 0.2 acres to mow. I will tell you, there is a difference. The tip speed, if you will, is different. There's a big difference between a commercial, even a push mower. And I'm not talking about like the big Skags or Hustlers or whatever, where they almost look like a snow blower setup, except it's a mower. I'm not necessarily talking about those. Just even a 19, 21, 22 inch, 25 inch wide or diameter, if you will, push mower, self-propelled or not. The commercial grade Toro is much, much different than the consumer model Toro or whatever brand. And you can see it. The cut quality is much better. You get better lift. So the blades are pulled up straighter, more vertical. The blade comes through much faster and it's just a more even cut. You get striping without really needing a roller or anything like that. It's a big difference. Is it worth it? I mean, I don't know. It's up to everybody. You know, we start pushing into, you know, an acre or more, and you maybe have a lot of trees or obstacles to go around. Zero turns make a lot of sense. I did a podcast episode about that relatively long time ago, about learning from the logic of a zero turn, about really blade to grass contact time for efficiency and productivity. So there's a lot of logic to that. Now, what's the terrain? If it's really flat and a fair number of obstacles, do you really need a $20,000 Skag? I mean, Pollock and I might argue you do, but it's a tough argument. And then you have, like I said, I guess what I brought up earlier is there's a lot of these companies have two categories. There is the consumer line and then the professional or commercial line. And they're much different. They're much different. If we stick to a little bit with the zero turns, the hydros are probably the thing you will notice the most. Blade tip speed, yes, but the hydros, that's where you're going to really notice the difference. What's driving the wheels, allowing you to steer, the response time, the power. If you take a consumer model zero turn on a bit of an incline, if you're going across the incline and you try to turn up, so if you're, you know, going across and up would be to your right to go up this hill, a commercial model might not be able to make the turn. It might slip because the tire widths are not the same. They're a little on the narrower side. And then also just the ability, the power to swing the assembly, you and the machine clockwise, doesn't exist, where a commercial will do it with little to no hesitation. And they usually have much wider wheels in the back, so they have better grip and the whole thing. And they're just built, right? They're built to go 8-10 hours a day, all every day, 6 days a week. And commercials or consumer models usually a little more towards the, you know, once a week for an hour or two. So really, it's just what do you want and versus what do you need? And I know people that have relatively large properties with a few obstacles and they buy consumer models and they buy them every few years and the money spent is about the same or slightly less than just buying the commercial unit. But yeah, the big names that come to mind are like the Toros and the X-Marks and the Skags. I think, honestly, it could be built by one of these companies, but I've seen Kubota, I think, has a pretty decent mower, zero turn. And then Gravely, Bobcat. I think Bobcat actually has a decent mower out now. Hustler is another one. And we Walker, they're kind of their own thing, but they're a heck of a machine. But those are, you know, we're talking more of the commercial models. And then you get into the more consumers, and I just suspect that there's like a lot of things, three or four manufacturers, like an MTD or something like that, that build almost all of them. And then it's down to the badging. And then really then it's what color do you like and what accessories do you like, you know, cup holders, the seat fits you better, armrests, stuff like that. It's about like anything. If there's any way to go try it, then do so. Whatever feels right, go with it. But yeah, if you've got a big yard with a lot of obstacles, you're probably better off buy once, cry once. Another one I don't want to forget also is the, I think Cub Cadet has some pro line machines that are quite, quite good. So yeah, that's, how do you answer that? It's rough without knowing a lot of details. That's the way I would push you to. And then honestly, I guess, you know what the real answer is? I should know. This should have been the initial response. Actually, I'm kind of disappointed in myself. What's your dealer support? If you have a Skag dealer very nearby and these other dealers are a long ways away and the Skag dealer is good, they have good reviews, you've interacted with them before, buy a freaking Skag or Kubota or whoever's nearby. Who do you have dealer support for or with? That's probably the real answer. It's not probably the real answer. That is the real answer. Because I think when you start getting to the commercial level, I mean, none of them really suck. They really don't. Electric and hybrid vehicles are here. And with them, a new era of diagnostics. Don't get left behind. Pico Technologies EV diagnostic kits are your all-in-one solution to safely and efficiently service any electric or hybrid vehicle. From comprehensive high-voltage system analysis and insulation testing to guided step-by-step procedures, Pico puts the power of confident repairs right at your fingertips. Future-proof your shop, boost your efficiency, and become the go-to expert for the next generation of cars. Visit PicoAuto.com today. That's PicoAuto.com. This episode of Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z is brought to you by Autel. Autel is a global developer and manufacturer of award-winning professional automotive diagnostic tools and service equipment, trusted by technicians, educators, and shop owners across North America. With diagnostics at their core, Autel's real-world solutions support repair workflows ranging from full-system vehicle diagnostics to servicing the most advanced automotive technologies. What sets Autel North America apart is the team behind the tools. Dedicated experts across sales, training, and technical support, each bringing deep, hands-on experience supporting professional technicians. When questions arise, you're working with people who understand the vehicles, the procedures, and the real-world demands of modern repair. Whether diagnosing complex drivability concerns, servicing TPMS systems, validating repairs, or working with ADOS and advanced safety technologies, Autel tools are engineered to support accurate, efficient repairs in strict accordance with OEM procedures and standards. To learn more about Autel and their diagnostic solutions, visit autel.com, AUTEL.com. Ever feel like you've got to play politics just to get fed? One guy gets the gravy, you get the garbage, and then the ad says, great culture. Independent Wrench Jobs is a new tech-only community to help you find better independent shops, fair dispatch, steady work, real leadership, no games. Start with the free salary survey for your city. Shop-by-shop pay, perks, and benefits before you waste another interview. And if you're applying now, use Autotech Resume Pro to generate a resume and shop-specific cover letter in about 2 minutes. Built by Technician Find, serving the industry since 2017. Join free at independentwrenchjobs.com. All right, the next question. Setting me up. Evidently, there's something going on, like, either online or maybe some other podcasts, and I don't know, but what is my take on flat rate? I am going to steal the answer of a great friend of mine, John Riggle. It depends. I think we all know that when you start using certain tactics like pay plans to motivate and to manage, really manage people, it's probably not going to work out too well. I think a lot of that is those plans are put into place to drive up production and kind of help with managing people by pay plan. And that's usually a horrible idea. You also have to just be very, very careful of what you're trying to motivate. And what if we lean into game theory a little bit, you are setting the rules of a game. What happens is you have these rules set up and you have these targets and goals and all the things to set up a game. And that's literally what it is. It's a game. And I'm not trying to compare it to Candyland, but it's the same thing. When you have certain goals, you have certain rules, people start to learn how to either manipulate the game or work within the game to net the best results or the for them. And you have to just be careful, right? Because flat rate can be full of contradictions where I want you to just crank out the work as fast as you can. But also, if something goes awry because of it, I'm going to hold you accountable. And then, which fundamentally isn't so bad, but I mean, how do you not answer depends, right? Because it depends on where the goals are, what it takes to get to those goals. And then is the system set up in such a way that someone can actually hit those goals? And then when somebody is unable to hit those goals, they're going to be looking for the reasons they can't. And are those reasons in their control or not? And if they're not in their control, now the game is set up against them and you wonder why there's a bad attitude. You've set up these goals. You've set up these rules. But the system is not in place. The system doesn't work to help people win. It immediately breaks everything, right? And I think historically, through all of things, at work, society, when people deem something unfair, they either quit or they try to break it. That's what you see. So is flat rate bad? No, but there's a lot of stuff in the background that has to be done. And there's a lot of things that have to be really fleshed out and everybody's understands. And I think if everybody within that system agrees and believes that it is fair, you're fine. But once it starts to be unfair, and I don't necessarily want to say like employees who are in that pay plan, when they don't get such a good paycheck, immediately decide it's unfair. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I'm sure there's example after example of people listening to this right now where they're just like, well, so-and-so and so-and-so, I got all kinds of examples. Are you sure? And then some of it is probably true. When people don't get what they want, you know, it's like Dutch wrote in his article, right? Looking in that mirror, it's rough. It's not just rough for an owner. That's who he's talking to in his article. And I think it was Ratchet and Wrench, where he's like a columnist. It's everybody. So why would you expect anything different to them? And yeah, you better take a hard look in the mirror and a hard look at the system and go, is it really fair? And look at them and go, do they really think the system is unfair? Or are they just upset because they didn't achieve the goal? And did they not achieve it because of them? You know, because it can be a meritocracy, but there's issues with it, right? There just are. They have to be addressed. And then when it's all said and done, you could probably pick any pay plan. And if it's deemed fair and everybody understands it and everybody buys into it, you're good to go. It doesn't matter the pay plan anymore. It's just, does everyone agree that it's fair? Does everyone agree that the system is set up so that everybody wins? I mean, I don't think we're talking about zero sum games, but we are definitely talking about negative sum. And if somebody believes that they are in a negative sum game, basically where the system is making it so they suffer versus the benefit of the shop, the benefit of management, the benefit of the owner, it's going to hell in a handbasket. Game, set, match. And you got to take a hard look at it. Is it as fair as you think it is? Yeah. And then you got to hammer out those details. You got to figure it out. It can work, but it just can't be, I need these production levels out of you, or I'm going to pay you X amount of dollars per hour for this many hours build, or whatever. We all know what flat rate is. But if you don't have the systems in place to order parts, to get the cars in as soon as possible and get things moving so that those, it's not just the technical or mechanical specialists, have what they need to be able to hit whatever monetary goals they have is really all for naught. It will fall apart. And you may find certain people that will play the game and just manipulate it to their favor. And they don't do it because they're nefarious by any means. It's what any intelligent human being would do. Flat rate is not fundamentally bad. It's a slippery slope, though. I think most of what we see are kind of hybrid plans. Where I work, the shop is profit sharing. So everybody has a base hourly or salary that's, I think, more than just livable. But then the profit sharing is what really starts pushing people up into that, you know, whatever tier you want to say. But I think I can prove it categorically that they're making well over the cost of living. It's really, what can we do to increase their spendable income? That's what it's all about. I want them to help me or help the shop generate as much ethical profit as they can. That's the deal. That's our game. And not to oversimplify it. That's ultimately what we're after. Flat rate is not fundamentally bad. It can be horrible, but so could pretty much anything that's mismanaged or not managed. It's like anything. I don't know. It's people, right? It's like, that's how I would answer that. Artificial intelligence. What do I think about it? That's a really vague question and almost I struggle with because what do we mean by AI? And I really don't want to go into this too much because there should be an episode on this podcast or on Sean Tipping and Tommy Oliva's podcast, Automotive Diagnostic Podcast, where we're going to talk more about AI. A couple of years ago, Sean and I talked about it, and now we need to update it a little bit. He's talked a little bit about it here and there. I've been holding off. But I guess what I will say is most of the time when people are talking about AI, they're talking about large language models, which would be ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, DeepSeek, Perplexity, Grok. I mean, those are kind of the heavy hitters, I suppose, technically, to a degree, at least, Siri. But I think Siri uses ChatGPT. Those are kind of like the heavy hitters that I can think of off the cuff. And those are large language models. And I guess what I would say is they're still, it's much more complex than this, but they're very much akin to predictive text on steroids. It's more complicated than that. And I don't want to oversimplify that, but that's really what it is. They don't know anything, but you're going to start seeing, I mean, clearly we've seen some massive leaps. That's all I'll say. Do I think there's a use for them? Yes. Do I think we have a danger of losing jobs in our profession? I don't think so. Yeah, I think I'll leave it at that and then look for an episode. And of course, I'll keep you posted with Sean and Tommy. Very much looking forward to that. Been looking forward to it for quite some time. Do I know any good marriage counselors? No. How do you answer that? Margaret Light is legit and legitimately good. But she can really only deal with certain states, right? And that becomes a problem. If you're in Minnesota, it's an option. I think Wisconsin, she's an option. You can check it out. Her website is, I just had it. Her website's Equilibrium Therapy. And yeah, just go on there, check it out. I think you can send her a message. And if she can't help you or work with you for whatever issues with licensing and all that, then hopefully she can refer you to somebody, and which I would think she could. And yeah, if you can, I don't know if she would do it. I don't know how many would actually do it, but I think there is logic in sending the shop to marriage counseling, like all of them. There's logic to it because communication is something else. And you know, you go to enough classes, all you hear about is communication. It's all about communication. You get to the point where when somebody says communication, you just want to throw up. Right. And then you have to go sit in on like a network class. It's so fed up with the word communication. But the reality is it's all about good communication. And there are some classes that you can hit that talk about that. And I think quite well. One of them is Tracy Capriotto's and Sarah Fraser's class. And then Margaret, I think, is doing classes. So at expos, Also, I think she'll be online doing some virtual stuff too. So keep your eyes peeled for that. Could you do your Mount Rushmore of bands? I don't know how you do that. It's like, make a Mount Rushmore of football players. What position? How do you answer that? If you're going to do it, how do you not put the Beatles on there? How do you not put Sabbath on there? Iommi gets his fingers pinched off, detunes his guitar, and creates a whole new genre. How do you not? Those are two. And then after that, this might seem somewhat insane, but this is the stuff I'm kicking around. Like, I could be wrong, but it seems to me like the first kind of boy band, if you will, and I don't mean boy band because they're all boys. I'm thinking more of like a assembled band. It's the Monkees. Part of me doesn't like that it's all staying in a, you know, these choices are kind of all in the same decades area. But I'm trying to think, like, I don't know how you make a Mount Rushmore of music bands without the Beatles. And I don't know how you ignore Black Sabbath. Like I said, they created an entire genre. The Monkees were assembled for a TV show and they end up knocking the Beatles off the number one. Like, that's not nothing. It's interesting, right? And I know like the Beach Boys and the Beatles had a thing back and forth. Brian Wilson kind of competing with Paul McCartney and John Lennon. Like, that's not nothing. But now how do you, who'd go in that fourth spot? And then do the Monkees really deserve to be in there? I mean, they're important. I'm sure there's like a country band that I've never heard of that should be on there. So people are screaming at their listening device right now, but I don't know any country bands. I guess I remember my parents watching the Country Music Awards when I was a kid, but I don't, I mean, I wouldn't be able to tell you who pushed the genre. Not my wheelhouse. If I went with the, I really don't like that they're all in this same kind of year range. That kind of bugs me. I think Sabbath and the Beatles have to be on there. That's pretty defensible. The Monkees might seem goofy, but there is an intent there, like a legit intent. So they can be like in a question mark right now. Do you count like the Supremes? Like that would be about like saying like Buddy Holly and the Crickets, but that's a band. You got what, the Temptations, Motown? Are they the ones that really got it rolling? What about the Sugar Hill Gang, right? For rap, I mean, hip hop, that they maybe started it, but I don't know if I could put them on the Rushmore over, say, like Run DMC. Well, so that this doesn't take freaking hour to do, I am going to go with the Beatles, Sabbath, Run DMC, and somebody might be able to really, really educate me, but I'm going to go with the Temptations as a Mount Rushmore. I'm sure there's some country band out there that's good. I doubt it. It's just, I don't know anything about it. It's not my thing. I'm sorry if you like it. I just don't. I can appreciate the popularity. And I guess, honestly, it's purely American, right? I should have some level of appreciation. It hurts me to keep certain bands off the list, right? I don't think there's been a bigger band than the Stones, or I guess the Eagles, honestly, aren't they like widely considered the most popular band in history? Somewhere like them, or I don't think the Stones were. I mean, they're up there, but I don't think they are, you know. But then you got freaking Metallica, which is just the juggernaut of heavy metal and thrash. But without Sabbath, there's no Metallica. But then also, I have Run DMC up over the Sugar Hill Gang. And do you have Run DMC without Sugar Hill Gang? But Sabbath was very, very popular. It's not like the Sugar Hill Gang versus Run DMC, where it's just like a big gap. One did lay down the foundations, but the other one just took it and ran, and it became one of the most popular genres of music we have. I'd rather do genres. So this just sucks. I'm going to stick with it. Beatles, Sabbath, Temptations, and Run DMC. Let me have it in the comments. And if you like this type of stuff and you're watching this on YouTube, give it a like. It really does help. What you think of these responses and what your top, you know, what your Mount Rushmores would be, I'm really interested to hear that. You can leave it in the, what do they call it, the doobly-doo in the on YouTube, or you can email me at mattfonzlepodcast@gmail.com. You can send me an instant message on Facebook Messenger. Thank you to our sponsors, Independent Wrench Jobs, Autel, and Pico Technology. Thank you to the Aftermarket Radio Network. And until next time, take care.
You've been listening to Diagnosing the Aftermarket A to Z with Matt Bonslow on the Automotive Repair Podcast Network. Download our exclusive podcast app at automotiverepairpodcastnetwork.com because the best conversations in the industry start here. Want Matt to cover a specific topic? Check the show notes for his email. Your input matters.